Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Mito Action's roundtable discussion with Dr. Pamela Tucker, PT, DPT, from Children's Institute of Pittsburgh and UPMC. Tonight, Pamela Tucker is with us to help us better understand serial casting and toe walking. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm a parent of a teen with LCHAD and a patient support coordinator at Mito Action, and I'll be your host for this evening. Tonight's discussion will be recorded and available on the Mito Action website in the coming days. This space is a little different than our traditional expert series. We set this call up as a Zoom meeting, which means that you have both video and audio access. We encourage you to turn your videos on if you would like, but please keep yourself muted throughout the presentation, as this will give everyone a more pleasurable experience. If you have questions throughout the presentation, please put them in the chat, and I can ask them at the end of today's presentation, or if you prefer, you can raise your virtual hand or your actual hand, and I can call on you after the presentation. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Pamela Tucker. Following her undergraduate studies at Duke University, Pamela Tucker obtained her Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Franklin Pierce University. Her clinical experience includes the management of outpatient and inpatient rehabilitation of infant, pediatric, and adult populations. She is a senior physical therapist at the Children's Institute of Pittsburgh and UPMC with specialties in pediatric, neurological, vestibular, and concussion interventions. Her research interests include physical therapy interventions for children with inherited metabolic disorders, aquatic physical therapy, which, if you didn't catch her presentation last month, I encourage you to go ahead and check that out. It's posted on our website. Concussion management and robotic-assisted mobility training. Dr. Tucker is currently working on a physical therapy protocol for recovering from rhabdomyolysis. Thank you so much, Pamela, for joining us tonight. We're so excited to learn all that you have to share. You're always a bundle of wisdom and are really great with sharing your knowledge with us. So thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here and share some about serial casting. So I'll start sharing my screen. Is everyone able to see my screen?
It says that it's still loading.
Okay.
There we go.
Perfect. So today I'll be talking about serial casting, which is a technique that physical therapists use to address hypomobility. In this instance, I'm going to be focusing on the lower extremities, most notably the calf and ankle musculature. It can be used on other parts of your body, but for the purpose of today's talk, this is the area I'll be focusing on. Some disclosures about me. I am a doctor of physical therapy. I work at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and the Children's Institute of Pittsburgh. I am an advisory committee member for Ultragenyx. I'm also an unpaid consultant for In Vitro Diagnostic Solutions, where I am collaborating on the CPK monitor, as well as a few other projects. For today's discussion, I want to go over generally what serial casting is, its effectiveness, and why it works, the clinical process of getting serial casted, and the indications, contraindications that we go through before we consider casting. At the end of today's talk, I would like to go over a case study of a patient that I worked with just this past year who had an FAOD. And while they were in the hospital, went through serial casting to improve their mobility. So, first of all, what is serial casting? It is a series of progressive casts that a physical therapist will put on an extremity with the goal of progressively positioning your joint for increased range of motion. It uses physiological principles of adaptation to elongate tissues and generate new cells. So this is an intervention that actually changes the orientation of the sarcomeres, which if you look in the bottom right corner, that's the smallest unit, the smallest acting unit of your muscle. So if you break it down to the muscles, the muscle bundles, the fibers, the fascicles, that's the smallest unit that we're working with. And we're elongating and rearranging how it's oriented. The uppermost picture is that series of casts. So you can see how we gradually increase the range until ideally we get a heel-toe gait progression. There are multiple different techniques for casting. For instance, therapists, both OT and PT, can use soft cast with plaster for wound healing or to address contractures. There's another technique that involves repositioning hip dysplasia in infants. It's a Ponseti method. This is typically done by PT, though some MDs do this also. Upper extremity casting is typically done by occupational therapists, and it's usually constraint-induced therapy. And the goal with that is most often after a stroke, if someone has lost some function on one side of their body, we may cast the strong extremity to encourage movement on their opposite side. For lower extremities, that casting is done by physical therapists, and it can include several different techniques and materials, such as soft fiberglass and/or polyester cast tape. The process to get in for serial casting starts with your physician who refers you to physical therapy. The PT or OT will evaluate you to determine if you are appropriate for casting and make a plan of care. Then you will come in and each week get a new cast put on you. This is a walking cast, and we encourage you to do all your usual activities. We actually want multiple thousands of compressive loads each day, ideally through the heel, weight bearing through your heel to elongate that tissue. After you're done with casting, we work together to develop a home exercise program and a post-cast plan of care. And that's usually an outpatient therapy. As I mentioned before, this can also be done in acute therapy, but primarily outpatient therapists are the ones doing this. So the big question is, why does it work? Why don't we just stretch? So our casts, what we set them at is something called the R1. We use a scale called the Tardieu scale, where R1 is the first resistance that is felt when you stretch yourself. For instance, if you were to stand up and keeping your feet on the ground, shift your weight forward without letting your heel rise, that first resistance that you feel is the equivalent of your R1. The extra range that you can gain, so pushing past that point, is your R2. R1 is where we all function with our mobility. That's the functional length of our muscle, and that is where I aim my goals to get to a level where people can walk over thresholds. They can step up curbs, they can clear their toe when they're stepping through when they walk. So that elastic range of R1 is our target. Then we use the stress strain curve, meaning there's a kind of like a sweet spot of enough stretch to trigger change over an extended period of time without pushing to an area where we cause damage. We also aim to remodel the structure of the muscle, as I mentioned before. This technique uses low load, long duration stretch on the muscle to create tension in the muscle and rearrange the sarcomeres. As I mentioned, simple manual stretching does cause some changes in soft tissue properties. However, we can get more benefit through serial casting and maximize our range of motion, especially in very contracted or tight individuals. The minimum time to see adaptive remodeling of soft tissues is 20 minutes. We use a low load stretch to prevent overstretch and damage of the muscle. The optimum position, so what I aim for when I put a cast on someone, is that we're getting optimal weight bearing. My target is through the heel when I'm doing the lower extremities. To get into casting, you must have appropriate clearance and the patient must be comfortable. So that's something where communication between anyone who comes to me for casting and me is really important to know I'm working in an area of comfort and we're getting good outcomes. Some indications for casting are listed here. So I'm looking to improve function. If someone's tight and they don't have enough range of motion in their ankle to get their toes up when they step and then clear their foot when their limb swings through. If they're having pain or contracture in their muscles, if they have any spasticity, if they have abnormal movement patterns, as I mentioned before, it can be used for wound healing, though that's usually a plaster technique. One of the most important measurements that I look for is that the R2, so the maximum range that I can stretch a muscle, is at least 10 degrees greater than the R1, which is that first functional level that the muscle is working at. Some precautions to serial casting are listed here. And this isn't something that you would necessarily have to memorize. This is something that your therapist will screen out for. These are more like yellow lights where it's proceed with caution. I have casted patients with some of these conditions, and it's up to the clinical judgment of your medical team if they will proceed or not. These are contraindications to casting. So if you have any of these conditions, I would say that we defer from casting at this time, that maybe we keep it in our back pocket as an option at a future date. But if you, for instance, have an unresolved fracture, I am not going to put a walking cast on you and have you weight bear through a non-union fracture. If you have impaired circulation in a DVT, it's a contraindication to stretch and put pressure on that area. If that R2 and R1, if those measurements are equal, I will also not put a cast on you because that means that I am pushing you into no stretch that you can give me. Other considerations are any edema in the area, open wounds, tethered cord in spina bifida, uncontrolled hypertension. So this is a question that I often get, and I typically cast children. I have casted adults, but often I see children in clinic who the parents are like, well, they toe walk, and they've always toe walked since they started walking, and the doctor just said they'll maybe grow out of it. When do I start getting worried? So as you can see in the picture on the right, the bones on our foot start very soft and ossification begins around that 6-month period and continues into teenage years. For me, and what the literature says is up to 2 years old, toe walking can be very normal for many children. Past 2 years old, and especially up until 4, is when I get concerned and when I would encourage a referral to physical therapy. Because the earlier we can work on it, the better outcomes we get. And it makes sense when you consider that if I'm seeing someone who's 6, 7, or 8, a lot of those bones are ossified, meaning they're solid in the foot, and they've gotten used to weight bearing in a particular position. It's very difficult to retrain that motor pattern and have the child learn how to shift their weight back on a less developed calcaneus, meaning the heel bone, after 3 to 4 years old. On the left, you'll see something called a sure step SMO. So this is a submalleolar orthotic. It's used after casting to help encourage a heel toe gait pattern. I encourage my patients to wear these typically for at least a year. I usually say wear it until you grow out of it, especially my older ones, my 6, 8, 9 year olds, because they have years of a habit that we're working on relearning a new walking pattern. Here you can see a timeline of gait progression. So if any of you have children, you've probably seen that they walk a little like drunken cowboys. They are very stompy with their feet. They take very short steps. There's a lot of kind of swinging their hips side to side as they mature. So past that 2 years of age, we should see a very good heel strike. And we should see an improvement of that knee flexion, meaning that bent knee and gait. Here is a visual aid for some of the terms that I've been using. So that first picture on the left, that one with the letter A under it, you can see when you first step, your heel hits the ground, and then you have a loading response where your knee bends slightly, your foot goes down flat, different muscles engage. At the one that's letter D, you have terminal stance where there's the most stretch on your calf, where your heel should lift, and it triggers the response in your ankle that helps you lift your foot and clear it so that you don't trip over it while you're trying to walk forward. So these are the things that we try to work on in therapy. What we found in the literature and in clinical practice is that functional gains from using physical therapy and casting last an average of 2 years after this treatment. And we see an increase in the passive movement, meaning if I were to stretch someone's foot into dorsiflexion, meaning toes are coming up to 3 years after a combination of therapy, so PT, casting, and Botox. Now, what I tell families is our bones grow faster than our muscles, which means that we're sort of like tight rubber bands where a child who toe walks may toe walk again after a growth spurt, especially if they don't stay on top of stretches or using their SMOs. What we do is another round of casting, but the kids who have gone through this tend to do really well because they know the program, they know what to expect. And usually the first round of casting is the longest. And after that, it's just like little tune-ups, sort of like you bring your car in to get oil changes, to get the tire rotated. We just do a little ankle stretch and balance gait tune-up. This is considered the most conservative management of toe walking and contractures, tightness in your calves. There are surgical options, which I have a mixed bag of outcomes. They do elongate the muscle. You do end up in casting still. Usually it's used on older children. If you imagine the tendon as a line, they make little Z cutouts in a pattern to encourage the fibers to grow and heal at a longer length. Next, we'll go into the process of casting. On the left, you'll see some of the materials that I use for casting. So you'll see cotton, stockinette, different types of foam, different casting materials, scissors, a goniometer, which is something that I use to measure your ankle movement. The first step is I clean your skin, I set the range that I want to cast you at, and I put a stockinette on your leg, and then I start to pad the area. So I use cotton web roll to cover all bony areas. Next, there'll be placement of foam on areas that tend to get high pressure. Usually I will do the heel, the malleoli, meaning the bones that stick out on the side of your ankle, your toe box. So just behind your toes where you'll see the bones kind of sticking out at the side of your foot. I also do a thin strip at the very top of the cast, about an inch or a thumb below the bone that sticks out of the side of your leg. If you feel your knee and then move straight out to the side, you should feel a little bump there. That's called your fibular head. After the foam, I put another layer of cotton on, and then I start putting the cast material on. So this will differ a little bit depending on your age. Younger children, so children 5 and under, I can do a mostly soft cast technique where I do a few layers of soft cast, and then I do a reinforcement of hard cast in an L shape to hold the stretch, followed by more soft cast. This cast is removable. The downside is once it comes off, it stays off. It's not something that you can put back on. Once you're past five and you get a little older, our bodies get bigger and we get stronger. I switched to a different technique that uses more hard cast material. I do still make this cast removable. How I do it is I will do layers of hard cast and then I split it with a cast saw. Now, this saw, it can be a little intimidating for kids. It can't cut you, it's a safety saw, but it can burn if the child moves too much and gets too agitated. It is very loud. I tell families it's like a very loud vacuum cleaner, and it's a little daunting to look at, and they can feel the vibration. Once I split the cast, I cover it with soft cast material that then the family is able to take off at home. That peels off sort of like duct tape, and then the hard cast splits apart. And we would do that each week. Usually it's 6 to 8 weeks that I tell families that we'll do casting. And after that, we follow it with outpatient physical therapy. After casting, it's really important that we do different exercises. So, daily stretching on an incline board, doing self stretches, wearing nightly bivalves. So, that is a hard cast that I've custom made for you, but it is something that you can take on and take off. So, I use Velcro straps to make it adjustable. It's not a walking cast like the cast that you had worn before, but you wear it at night to prevent the muscle from tightening up and losing some of that mobility that you gained. Some strengthening exercises are focused on the glutes, the calves, and the core. And I've listed a few examples of things that I do with children and adults in clinic. I should have added the adults that I've casted have primarily been patients post-stroke. And they've been mostly people looking to either improve their gait or stability or to get back to running because you need quite a bit of mobility in your calf for that dynamic push off. Next up, I'd like to go into a case study. This was a 5-year-old female. She presented to UPMC Children's in the fall of last year. Her diagnoses included cardiac failure. She was awaiting a heart transplant. She was VLCAD positive. She was also experiencing rhabdomyolysis, and she had autism, and she was nonverbal. She had quite an array of services, including PM&R, metabolics, genetics, nutrition, and internal medicine. The team's concerns and why I was consulted, because I did not personally treat this patient, but I was consulted and involved in her plan of care, was her metabolic fragility. Her CK levels were continuously elevated over 300,000, her volume load in the setting of heart failure, and her poor tolerance for mobility. Here you can see some of the goals that we had for this patient. So we were looking to improve her ankle range of motion, improve her ability to walk at least 350 feet with stable vitals. Have her be able to participate in at least 20 minutes of therapeutic activities with stable vitals, jump forward a target distance, jumping and landing with 2 feet, and going up and down 12 stairs. These were goals made by an acute care therapist with the aim of getting this child back home. The child participated in 6 casts. She did normalize her gait mechanics and normalized her ankle range of motion. So she met those goals. And she improved her ankle balance strategy. So she was able to walk over things like grassy surfaces, over mats, without stumbling and having to rely on mom and dad. She was discharged to home with close follow-up from the Johns Hopkins genetics team. She was very strongly encouraged to follow up with a pediatric physical therapist to maintain this range of motion and gait gain and reduce her risk of regression. So, some conclusions about serial casting and physical therapy. It has many potential benefits for multiple patient populations, and especially for patients with FAODs. Potential gains include improving the range of motion, improve pain management, improve flexibility, more efficiency in gait for energy conservation, and improve balance strategies. However, the evidence is limited. There is limited evidence of any efficacy during blackout. There's no current clinical practice guideline of if serocasting should be used during metabolic crises, and further study is absolutely needed. Here you can see some of my references. Now, I'd like to open it to any questions that you may have.
Well, we've had several different questions come in, but please know too that if you have a specific question, that you are more than welcome to raise your hand and ask them. I'm curious, one of the questions that came in, I was curious in regards to, you mentioned the harder cast for some of the older kids and how it can that you can split it open. Do they typically for the older kids, do they take the cast off in that 6 week time period that you're talking about? And how often do they do that? And what does that look like?
Yes. So the like I said, I make all of my casts removable, and my reason is that if anything happens, I want families to be able to take it off at home and not have to go to an emergency room and get someone with a cast saw to have to cut it off. The hard cast, just like the soft cast, unfortunately can't go back on after it's been taken off. It also cannot get wet. That's another downside. If the cast gets wet at all, I strongly encourage patients and families just to take it off, and I completely understand. I have had a family that sometimes children do like the feel of the cast. They like the weight of it, and it just gives you like global proprioceptive input to the leg. I had one family that they hiked all of Niagara Falls in the cast, which was a bit ambitious. And unfortunately, this was a kiddo who did like the feel of the cast, so he left it on. And when he came into clinic and he still had the cast on, I started taking it off. And that was a not great situation because water had gotten into the cast and it was right next to his skin. So his skin ended up being very fragile and macerated. So, meaning it was like if you've been in a pool for a very long time, you know how your skin gets very, soft and white, and it was not intact, and we could not continue casting for I think 2 weeks while his skin healed. So I encourage families to do this, to plan ahead. We're planning for 6 weeks of casting. Each week I make a new cast, but I encourage you the night before or the day before to take the cast off and have a break, to get a nice shower, to take a bath, scrub your leg, let your skin breathe, practice walking a little because it will feel pretty strange. And I tell families, please don't be concerned if they walk around like baby giraffes learning how to walk, because that's all very normal.
That's helpful. So in that time when they take the cast off, they could use that as their swim day if they're looking to swim or something in the summertime. But swimming with the cast would not be advised otherwise. Or
Right.
is there a special mechanism for taking a shower that you can cover it?
Yes, so they do make cast covers and they sell them at Walgreens, on Amazon, and it looks sort of like a big plastic bag that has a zip around the top of the calf. I've had other families use garbage bags, and other families just do sponge baths, and others just have the kids' legs outside of the tub.
So, in regards to toe walking, why do kids or adults toe walk? What is the reasoning or mechanism behind that? Or is it different for everyone?
It can have multiple reasons. There does seem to be the potential for a genetic component. There can be kids with sensory needs or adults with sensory needs where it reduces some of the foot contact with the ground and it helps with a bit of focus and decreased of feeling overwhelmed with sensation. Some kids, especially if they have different tone in their body, meaning tone, if you haven't heard of it, think of it like your body's and muscles' readiness to move. It's sort of like the average tone is like a hair tie, and you're able to use a few twists to tie your hair back in a ponytail. Low tone is like a really stretched out hair tie or rubber band where it still works, but it takes more work. You have to loop it around multiple times to get it to hold that ponytail. A person with high tone would have a really tight rubber band that it also still works, but you have to really stretch it out to get it to work. So some kids, when they have different levels of tone, they find other ways of moving that to us, once we become adults, we think, this is wild. Why? It's so hard to stay balanced on your toes. Why would you walk this way? But they can use it for a bit more momentum. So when they're learning how to walk, going on your toes actually saves you from engaging your core and your glutes as much. So to them, at that point, it is more efficient because they're able to rock up on their toes, tip forward to step. The problem is that once they get a little older, if they've stayed in that motor pattern and now they're 3, 4, 5, their bones are ossified in that position and they have very weak cores and glutes, and then they're losing energy because they're trying to do higher level skills to keep up with their peers, like riding a bike, running, jumping, skipping. That is very difficult for them to do.
So if you are older, like if they hadn't caught the toe walking early, or let's say you have an energy deficiency, like mitochondrial disease, and so maybe it doesn't progress until you get older. So why, maybe the first question then is, does that change like how, I think you said ossification, like in regards to like if you just started experiencing it more at age 8 because of an energy deficiency versus it's something that's progressed, like will you not have that ossification issue going on? Does that affect that or?
So your bones should have ossified in a typical pattern. And you can tell, usually someone who has toe walked for a long time, if you look at their heels, it will actually be quite a bit smaller than someone who, once they learned how to walk, they did weight bearing through their heel and had that compressive force. So someone, if they were older, walked pretty typically, but then they became contracted. If they met other criteria, like if I had some flexibility in the muscle tissue to stretch into it, I would think trying serial casting would be worthwhile. And that seems to be at least what this case study indicates. And it's true that a case study is a single person, so it can't be generalized to the whole population, but it seems like looking into it a little bit more might be very helpful and interesting.
So, and another patient asked, what did you, they asked if you could explain a little bit about the older kids with the Z-shaped cutting to elongate the muscle. Can you speak to how that works? And then I'm also curious, like, can you try serial casting? And then if it doesn't work, then move to that? Like, will some people push to like try the surgery before the serial casting? And what's the reasoning behind that?
So, forgive my art for just a second. Well, imagine your heel is here, and you've got your Achilles tendon here, and up here is your muscle, your calf muscle. When they do tendon lengthening, it's like they take little snips out in this sort of zigzag Z pattern. And the purpose is to cause a micro trauma that then, in the healing process, more tissue stretches out to fill that gap. Usually, that happens after conservative measures have failed. So I would say, and that's what the clinical practice guidelines tell us, definitely try physical therapy, try more conservative things, try serial casting, try Botox with serial casting first. And if that's failed, then consider surgery because surgery comes with its own risks. I do have families that, once the children are a bit older, 8, 9, or 10, they do see surgery as potentially a quick fix. Fortunately, I do feel like it has its own issues where you do end up in a cast still for several weeks while you're healing. And there is a pain aspect of managing that. And still, you need physical therapy to relearn how to walk with that elongated muscle. Because once you come out of any casting, it's sort of like trying to walk with stretched out rubber bands again. It's very strange, and you have to shift where you have been weight bearing and your core, your center of balance.
Are there more risks for complications with like the neurons with the surgery versus serial casting? Like neuron damage because you're actually cutting into an area versus, or are there similar issues with the serial casting?
Oh, so serial casting has minimal risk to neuron damage. We're just aiming to elongate the muscles. Any surgery does have the risk of potentially causing damage to a nerve that's traveling through that area. And that just is with any surgery, I would say. This is much less invasive, which is why it's considered very conservative.
So for calf strengthening, this person asked for calf strengthening. What is a BAPS board? I'm not going to pronounce these correctly. A tibialis anterior strengthening?
So a BAPS board is something, think of it like a giant oval that it has a rocker, so kind of like a circular support on the bottom that comes in different sizes. So after someone has had an ankle injury, I might have them put their foot on the board and just work on controlling their movement of tipping their foot front and back, side to side, into circles. And then you progress it and you make that surface smaller so they have to have more fine-tuned control of that movement. The tibialis anterior, that's the muscle at the very front of your calf. So if you wiggle your ankles up and down, the muscle that you feel turn on to lift your foot up, that's called your tibialis anterior. So different exercises I do to strengthen that is big shoe walking. So I'll have children walk in like dad's shoes or swim flippers that they really have to pick their toes up. I'll have them hook their feet in like the underside of a cabinet and do different balance exercises. So they're holding their bodies up using their feet in that way.
So you mentioned some possible contraindications with serial casting. And so there's a couple of questions about that. One is in regards to muscle weakness. They were asking, can you have muscle dominance where it's easier to balance on one side without it being considered a muscle weakness?
You can definitely have dominance. We all actually do have a dominant side. It may not be the same side in our legs that it is in our hands, but all of us, we do have that, and that's not necessarily considered weak. Yes, maybe if we tested, you might have slight weakness compared to your dominant side, but that wouldn't be a screen out for casting.
Is toe walking the only symptom of muscle weakness that you see? Is that like primarily for the lower extremities?
Are you asking if I see patients other than toe walkers, or could you clarify the question?
Yeah. The patient that asked it, I wonder if they could clarify that question.
Okay, you had mentioned, Pam, that you're, because you keep going back like to toe walking, and then you said like at around age two, you know, a lot of kids will grow out of it, and so I guess I was just wondering, because I feel like maybe we started there, but then we kind of maybe didn't get into the correct heel, like toe heel placement. So I guess I was just wondering if for serial casting, like, are you just looking at, because you referenced toe walking a lot, but as the kids get bigger, you know, they're not walking on their toes as much. And so I guess I was just wondering about the possible other conditions for the serial casting. I know it's to like elongate the muscles.
Yes. Okay. I understand. Yes. So other conditions that I will use serial casting for are strokes, both adult and pediatric. Cerebral palsy, both adult and pediatric, I've done casting for. Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but that's a condition that affects young men where they get pseudohypertrophy in their calves. It's a progressive condition where they gradually lose function. Unfortunately, it is a terminal illness right now, until we have more research to hopefully come up with a cure. I'm actually currently casting a young man with this condition who's 8, and I'm casting him because he is no longer able to walk, but my goal for him is that he can have a bit more independence with his self-care. I would like him to be able to, for instance, be able to stand up after using the restroom and be able to do hygiene. He's can't do any standing at this point because he is so contracted in his calves, and it's very painful for him, and he can no longer tolerate any stretching to his calves. So my goal for him is that we can at least get his foot flat, although we will not aim for heel toe gait because, as I mentioned, it's a progressive condition.
Do you have any follow-up questions, Kim, to that?
No, I think that I got it.
Another parent asked, their daughter has Lee's disease and had serial casting done to her ankle to try to get it to a neutral use, to try to get it to neutral to use her AFO without pain. You mentioned the night cast. Can you explain more about it, as they only got an AFO, but they did not get a night cast?
Mm-hmm. So at least this is my practice and how I was trained. I follow the Cincinnati clinical practice guidelines, which are accepted by the APTA as best practice for casting. I, once I'm done with casting, will make a custom bivalve, which I have patients wear at night, especially if they've been a toe walker for several years. And the job of that is to hold the stretch where they are at, because you will lose some range pretty much immediately after stopping casting, just because we're not progressively loading that muscle and you're going about your day, going to school, things like that. If you're in AFOs and if you're not seeing regression in your range, and I would just ask your therapist and like check on how the walking is feeling and looking, then it seems like maybe they made the clinical decision that the bivalves weren't necessary if there was enough stretch happening with the AFOs. This is just the practice that I follow.
This is my daughter. I'm talking about the one with the Lee's disease. I thank you, Pam, for your information. My daughter doesn't walk. She's using a wheelchair, but we used the serial casting to help with her very tight ankle that was hard for me to get in the AFOs. And then she was have like pressure sores because her torn was, you know, with Botox also was not like, you know, it's on and off, like, you know, it wears out fast. Mm-hmm. So she did have serial casting when she was younger on the left ankle. And that was successful. That was like, you know, about, she was 10 years old. And that was like lasted maybe like, what was it, 6 to 8 weeks. And her leg, like, are, even though, like, you know, we still use AFOs, but I can stretch her, like, you know, like on, like inward, outward, up and down on the left fine. Then she started having problems actually on the right leg when she got older. And I think I wrote also in the note that when she was about 13 or 14, we tried to do the knee stretching. So she had like a full leg kind of casting. So we can avoid, you know, the muscle, the thigh muscle surgery. But she ended up getting some pressure sores, and we, you know, just stopped the whole serial casting for that. And we never went back because, like, her skin was very sensitive. Okay. But since her right leg's been having a hard time, and, like, really, like right by the ankle, you see the bone sticking because her leg would just turn outward so much, and it was hard for me to put it in the AFOs, and we asked for serial casting for about a couple of years, and they decided finally to approve it. So we did actually, I think it was about, I think close to 3 months we ended up going, because it was, there were three areas that they were working on. I think was like trying to go inward and like tilt it to be neutral, and there's another, like, there were three different areas they were trying to correct on her right ankle. And it is closer to neutral now. I can like little bit stretch it to the inward, but I'm like if I don't have her in the brace, like her leg just goes back like right away tight. And I was wondering about the night thing because like I remember them mentioning something like if your insurance will cover that or else you would use the same AFOs that she's using, you know, day and night. But that was uncomfortable and like her legs would be sweaty and you know, like in the morning and like actually somehow when she woke up in the morning her legs would be more red than if she wore them just at night comparing to just the day. So I wasn't sure how like that would like you said, like you do a bivalve cast or something. But we finished this back in November. So like it's been about like 5 months now, 6 months that we've won. And her legs still like, you know, give me a hard time if she's not in an AFOs. But it did help her a little bit, I wanna say, like, you know, with the so that I can stretch it before it was very hard for me to like, you know, even to try to get it to neutral. But now I can get it to neutral, but it's starting to get tighter. And you mentioned something about maintenance, like so like how many like is it like a year or so that if I see it's losing it again, do we go back, suggest to the doctor to go back and do like another maybe shorter term, not 3 months, but like you know, like I said, the 6 to 8 weeks, is that something you know suggest or like something you would think that would be beneficial?
I'm sorry that that casting was so long, and I'm very sorry that she had the pressure sores from that because it's just painful, and I'm just sorry that was her experience. So my thought for her, if I was seeing her and she came back, would be to maybe actually try a series of bivalves. And I've done this with some patients that have very sensitive skin or are having trouble tolerating or progressing with the casts. So it's worn at night, and it's like the serial cast, but instead of a walking cast, we start with just wearing it at night and gaining a slightly less stretch, but still a stretch a little bit more each week until we can get into serial casting. That would be something that I would consider trying. It sounds like the night splint they were debating, there is an over-the-counter one that is not custom that some insurances do cover. I think I've only had one or two patients that have been able to get those. So I can't talk too much on their overall efficiency, but it seemed like they tolerated those pretty well. I'm a bit of a fan of something custom made to someone's foot, especially if
Yeah, I
someone,
know. I would agree because her like foot and like there's different like sensitive areas, like you know, the ankle, the toes, they all like different areas, like something has to be like custom, you know, to her different tone, like you know, she has spasticity, dystonia, like sometimes her toes goes up, sometimes they go down, like and the way they like turn is different. So like they have to be, like you said, custom to her, like where her pressure areas are. And we did we struggle with the new AFOs. We had to go like for like few appointments for them to like able to for her to tolerate. After the serial casting 3 months that she spent in. But they fit now, okay. That's my question is like what's the night because I don't want her to lose it as much. But then again, you know, I can't use those AFOs too much on her. We give her like little breaks, like you said, and she goes in the standard and but I'm feeling that like the effect of it are a little bit wearing off now. Like I'm feeling like more tightness than like when we started. But not as
It
much.
might be a good time. It might be a good time to consider going back to therapy. I don't know if she's someone who's had Botox injections before, but that would be something I would consider trying.
I think her doctor actually is gonna go back to the Botox because she missed a couple when she was in the cast, and she said next time in June we're gonna try to give something for the ankle again that she used to give Botox in. I'll ask her again about that. You said what is it called?
Bivalves.
Bivalves. Okay.
Something else to consider if you are planning on getting Botox and doing casting is to plan ahead and get scheduled early because there is a sweet spot with Botox injections too. That's typically around that 14-day period after Botox that we want to have started casting, which I'm sure you know, but I just
Yeah,
want
they
to
did
share
that.
with everyone.
Yeah, we were like we couldn't do it like a couple of times because like there was no openings and we had to wait for the next round of Botox. And then like they had her on the schedule to start that. And that was back in September, I want to say, and to November that we started because, you know, they were going slow because of her history of this pressure sores. So they were not going. So like it took us like that much to decide, okay, like we come close to neutral now, like, you know, as neutral, you know, without like going over. And they said that I guess the insurance, you know, stops at that point, working with it. But yeah, so yeah, she's gonna get the Botox, I think, this next round, in her leg. And then, but I wasn't sure about maintenance going back to serial casting, like in a year or so, something like that. Like you had patients come back, like, you know, you said something about maintenance where it's not as long. But they do come back for toe, but
Yes.
like for about just for ankle being, you know, the ankle being like outward or like tight to come to neutral.
Yes. And I would say that's very patient specific. I've had patients that come back after a year because they got tight or went through a growth spurt, or they come back every couple of years.
Okay.
One child I'm thinking of that I saw in New York, she had cerebral palsy, and each summer we planned for serial casting because she would get tight over school because she was a multi-sport athlete, and her affected side, she needed more mobility to do all the things she wanted to do.
Okay, so you do have that kind of like some patients with depending on their needs. So I feel like I bring it up to the doctor, like, you know, every year or so, every few year and a half or something, do more stretching to hold it,
Yes.
maintaining it. Okay, well, that's a good point we can bring next month to her. All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate you sharing your story too, because it's definitely stirred some extra questions and the chat, and just really appreciate you sharing
Yeah.
some of the questions that came through while you were sharing that maybe others that are a little bit less familiar with serial casting is as they were asking what is a bivalve, what's an AFO, and can you explain a little bit about what Botox does?
Sure. So a bivalve is just a name for a cast that you wear at nighttime. It's made out of the same material. It's just removable and you can put it back on. The problem is that you can't walk with it. You can't go through your normal day with it. It's designed to maintain the stretch that you've gained and prevent you from tightening up. Because usually, as we go about during our days and we're running to and fro, we're doing things for school or work or errands, our muscles get tight. I'm sure we all feel that before we go to bed at night. And the job of the bivalve is to try to help keep you in a good range without letting that tightness build up and build up. I tell families it's something that if you need to get up in the middle of the night and use the restroom, it's okay for that, but beyond that, it's not meant to be walked in.
Okay.
And then Botox, that was the next question, right?
Or
Or
AFO. I don't know
AFO.
if which you want
Okay.
to talk about first.
So there are different orthotics. A lot of us think of orthotics as like the inserts that go in our shoes that help if you are flat feet or if you round your arches too much. And those are a type of orthotic. They make more supportive orthotics such as SMOs, AFOs, and it goes higher up. It's just named for the body part that it's at. So an SMO is a supramalleolar orthotic. So it covers those two bones that poke out at the side of your ankle. Those are some of the most common for toe walking, if it's just toe walking, because it stops you from being able to rock forward on your toe. It encourages you to stay in that heel to toe gait pattern. You can have more supportive orthotics. So AFOs would go higher up to just below the knee, and you can go higher up to the hip, up to the lower back. It's based on the body part that it's helping you with, and it just depends on what kind of weakness or instability that you have or tightness. So, Botox, think of how your muscles work as sort of like a telephone line going from your brain to the muscle. The Botox helps interrupt some of those calls going through. So it helps the muscle relax, and that can lead to a better stretch. Or with serial casting, it can help someone who's very, very tight tolerate the cast better and get more range than we would normally. It can help the casting go a little faster too.
So what if the tightness builds up and is not something like, how do you proceed with PT? Like if it's something that maybe builds up throughout the day or it doesn't always stay the same?
Is this if someone's not in PT or if someone's in PT but they're having tightness that's keeping them from doing things?
So like I think more, you talked about growth spurts. And so especially with that, when you have more like when you have tighter muscles after the bones have grown and the muscles have not yet elongated. So I'm kind of talking about that, but I'm also curious as far as you had brought up just a part about sometimes like if the gait can be off, like the knee flexion, that's kind of what we're dealing with, I think what I'm seeing. And you said it requires more energy to like, activate your core and, to build up your glute, your weaker glute muscles. And so I guess what I'm asking is what, because like serial casting goes hand in hand with PT as well, but what are your favorite exercises as far as increasing like to kind of loosen all that up? Does that
Focusing more
and
on
strengthen
the
like
hamstrings for that bent knee, is that what you're thinking of, or more on the calf?
I think that's the problem, right? Because it's all interconnected, as far as and so I feel like so like I feel like the stiff running you were talking about, and so I think it's a knee flexion thing, but I don't know if it's also related to hips then, right? And then weaker glutes. So I guess I'm asking about, and we are in PT, but the tighter heel cords or the tighter calf muscles. He's tight all
So,
over them.
okay. So I think I'm understanding. Very generally, without being able to do an examination and see
Sure.
where restrictions are actually coming from, I am a fan of more dynamic stretches before we're doing activities. So things that like standing and touching your toe. So think of it like kind of like you're marching. Imagine you're marching in a parade, but your leg goes straight out in front of you and it's like you're trying to touch your toe. That's a pretty good dynamic hamstring stretch. I like to get both or multiple sides of the body, so I usually follow that up with quad stretching of like butt kicks, so walking and trying to bring your heel towards your bottom. Another good dynamic hamstring stretch is if you get your foot in front of you and your heels in contact with the ground, kind of making a sweeping motion. It's some people call it a bow. Some of these exercises have different names, but it's sort of like you bend forward at your hips and you try to sweep down your leg. So those before activities are some of my favorites. After activity, we know that more of the traditionally thought of stretches are a better cool down. So, some of us might have in our gym experience things like having to do a long sit, like trying to reach and touch our toes and have it measured in a presidential fitness test, or trying to stand and like put our hands on the ground or touch our feet. Those are more static stretches. They're better for a cool down than before activity. They're still good stretches and they're still good things to use. But if you're using that before, like doing a sporting event or things like that, I would try to switch things up and do more dynamic stretches. One of my favorite things for the calves is a low load, long duration calf stretch where you stand on a slight incline. You can get a little incline wedge, or I've had families kind of construct one, or you can stack up some towels and put your toes and the ball of your foot on that stack and let your heels hang backwards. and hang out there for a little while. Watch some TikTok, watch mom or dad make dinner, do some homework. If you can be there for a while, it's not the biggest stretch. We're not looking for a lot of tension on the muscle, but we're looking for that longer duration, trying to work up to 20 minutes. That's a really great stretch to do for the calf.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And thank you for the reminder about the dynamic stretches pre-activity. So thank you.
Of course.
Pam, can you talk a little bit? You've mentioned this a little bit about casting, serial casting after strokes. What is that like, or what has that been like in your experience for patients?
So often after stroke, there'll be some form of hemiparesis, meaning half of the body is affected, where it's much more difficult to move, things get tight. In the calf, what that looks like is a plantar flexion contracture. So the toe is pointed down and the heel has a hard time striking the ground, which can lead to kind of a limping gait where you're shifted over the stronger side, where you're not getting a good heel strike. You have a harder time balancing on that side. So my adults with strokes, I've used casting to try to increase the range and address the contractures on that side to work on their balance and their walking. And it's usually similar to the kids. Usually, I aim for 6 to 8 weeks. Something I should add into this is these appointments, as Refka probably knows, they are longer appointments. I tell my families to expect, especially for the first cast, probably 2 hours for me to build the cast for them. And if you're older or a bit larger, I use the casting technique where I build a foot plate and I'm using more hard cast material and I use a cast saw. So that's just a bit more lengthy, and it's a while to sit there and try to be as still as you can, because one of the things I have to watch out for is excessive movement or slumping. Lots of kids kind of like to do this slow slide in their chair, which can affect the angle of the cast, and that's something that we have to be really careful with because I want a nice slow progression of around 5 degrees each week. That's my goal that I aim for.
That's helpful to know. It's helpful to know what the progression is and also just the length of time to expect with the appointments, especially if you've never gone to one before, you're thinking about it. So I appreciate that.
Yes, and if you go, please wear loose pants. Please do not come in your favorite tight blue jeans. It is a cast that will not cover your knee, but will come below your knee. And it is very difficult to get off your favorite pair of jeans when you have a cast on your leg.
That's a very important tip. I think you've just saved people some clothing issues in the future. So one last question, unless I see any more come through the chat, which I think one just did, but I'm curious. Okay, well, let me ask this one first that came from Kim. She asked for casting, does it work more acute after, like right after stroke?
To my knowledge, we haven't done any good studies on serial casting in the acute phase after a stroke. Most of the casting that I've done has been, I'm trying to think the earliest. I think still the earliest they were at least 1 year out post-stroke, but that would be interesting to look at.
So you mentioned a little bit the possibility of wound healing. How does that work with the casting?
So that's a completely different casting technique than I've been talking about. With that, you use a plaster mold around the area, and it's especially used in burns. So we'll layer the area, and it acts to protect it and create an optimal environment for healing. It's something that I haven't gotten to do too much of, actually, but hoping to maybe learn in the future.
So is it the PT, like if you have an area that is being challenged with healing, like is that something that you would talk to a PT about, to your who do you talk to in regards to serial casting and wound healing?
So with wound healing, that would more typically happen in the hospital, more acute care or inpatient rehab. And that would be if you, say, presented to the burn unit and say there's a therapist there who does casting. the medical team would talk with you about, we are considering this intervention for you. Are you agreeable to try it?
Okay, one last question, and then I promise we won't hold you any longer, but we appreciate it. There's lots of questions. Do you cast both legs at the same time? And if so, when would you choose to do that versus one leg at a time?
So yes and no. So if someone comes into me and they're contracted or tight in both calves, I will plan to do both legs that day. I am only one person, so I will do one leg first and then I will move on to the other leg, but you will leave the clinic with two casts on. I have done just one leg, and usually that's with patients with strokes because their other side is typical, neurotypical.
Okay. And then the patient, it just sounds like because it's a walking cast, they just have to learn to walk on that cast. Do you help them figure that out, I assume, like in clinic, because it has to be kind of disorienting.
It is a little strange. I tell them it's going to feel like a big ski boot if you've ever walked in one of those. So you don't need any special device. You don't need crutches or anything like that if you don't normally walk in one, but it will feel like a heavy boot.
That's really helpful. Well, thank you so much, Pam. We really, really appreciate you taking the time to explain all of this, present new ideas and thoughts as we're trying to figure out how to help our muscles and have a better understanding of what serial casting is and how to ask our clinicians about it. So we really, really appreciate you and taking the time to explain all of this.
Let me know if you have any questions. I included my email at the end of the PowerPoint, and I'm here if you need me.
All right, till next time.
Bye. Have a good night.
Bye.